Welcome, everyone, to the Golf Beneath the Surface podcast. Really, we would also, I would like to welcome us back because it's been a minute as Chase and I are burning the candle at both ends. And some of the topics we'll get to today are part of the reason why that we have been away is that we've been working with a lot of people who are under some pressure and dealing with what comes with that pressure, both internally and externally. So we'll get to a little bit of Q&A again today to try to catch up where we have been away for a little bit of while. And then the next couple of episodes, we're going to get into habits and how we can start to understand them better and change them. And one of those habits we'll get to is kind of this, we tend to meet things with resistance, and that tends to run out as you get toward the top of the learning curve, wherever that might be for each of these people. So that's where we are. Chase, you're here. Hey, guy.
Doc, I've missed your pretty face. I'd like to see you more than once every month and a half, but it's been, these last couple of months have been pretty busy for both of us. And as you mentioned, we've having a lot of phone calls after rounds talking about some different struggles and challenges that our golfers are facing. And it's funny because I have the same conversations with 20 handicaps as I do with sometimes, you know, chasing the tours or chasing college golf or chasing, you know, playing on the PGA or LPGA tours. And it's, you know, we all struggle with some of these psychological issues, struggles, whatever you want to call them. And this game's hard, and we would like to accept all outcomes, and we would like to be on time for every shot, and we'd like to do all the stuff that you've talked about, but it's not easy. It is not easy. And it's an everyday struggle.
Yeah. Simple and easy are not the same thing.
They are not. We're going to try to get a few episodes on the, get a few episodes back on the schedule here shortly and get caught up a little bit and apologize for our delay. But we're going to continue providing as much good information as we can, as often as we can.
As often as we can. A big wide open promise with no real restrictions and parameters to it, just exactly. The way I like it. Okay. Exactly right. All right, Chase, we've got a handful of questions here today. Let's see if we can't get through. And just, again, these have been kind of the main themes that people have been contacting us with and trying to get some information about, see if we can't fill in some stuff. So one that I got was people, particularly a couple of people, just interested in what they call shot DNA, my understanding is what they're talking about is like, what do people do before or during a shot to try to set themselves up for hitting a good shot? So essentially, like the time you arrive at your ball to the time that you actually play the golf shot, like what does that look like in a way that might give some people some perhaps some do's and don'ts or some parameters to work with?
Yeah, for sure. So I really like what Vision 54 ladies did with the kind of the think box and the play box. And basically the way we kind of described it when Hal Sutton and I worked together was we would talk about kind of the office, and the office was behind the golf ball. And so what that meant is like when you set your bag down, you're going to start gathering as much information as you can. And that information includes, you know, all of our kids these days just grab the laser and fire right at the flag and they're going to get one number. And it, obviously that's not conducive to world-class golf, but laser the flag. And then I want to know, you know, what's the front of the green? What's the back of the green? Where's the trouble? You know, we talk a lot about, you know, we don't want to psychologically avoid anything, but we want to strategically avoid a lot of things. And so gathering as much information as possible. And so that's the office. The office is we're gathering information to decide what we want to do. And so we use certain holes, take 17 at Sawgrass, the famous island green. So let's just say the pin's in the back, middle back, kind of a Saturday or a Friday pin. We're going to laser to the pin. We're going to laser to the back. We may even laser to the front. Now we're going to gather as much information about the wind and the temperature and everything as we can. As it cooled down throughout the day, is it still really hot? Is the golf ball still flying? Anything that can affect how far that golf ball is going to land. So, or fly. So say it's a 140 yard shot to the flag. We've got 145 back edge. We've got 135 to carry the ridge. Like all these things are very important for us to know those numbers. Say there's no wind at all. So I'm looking at a 136 carry. Now we're going into, okay, my pitching wedge flies 130. My 9-iron flies 145. Now, is it a big wedge or is it a soft 9? And, you know, Doc's smiling a little bit because just in that little saying, there's a lot that goes on in these decisions. And for us, and for what I try to get my players is just to have as much clarity as possible. I don't care if they mess up. Where I get frustrated sometimes is when they mess up without a precise game plan. You know, if we're going to, you know, shoot a basketball, if we're going to you know, Doc works with a lot of rifle, you know, people shoot rifles in Olympic sports and different sport. I forget what's that sport actually called? Rifling?
Well, it'd be sports shooting, but rifle is one of them. Yeah.
Sorry, I was going complete blank with that. So sports shooting, right? We're aiming at specific targets, and I want my players to do the same thing when they grab a golf club. So let's just say we've committed to, we're going to hit a soft little nine, trying to fly at 135. Now the goal is, can we get on time? Can we accept all outcomes, and can we swing as freely as we can? We've got the game plan. We've locked into the office, and we know exactly what we want to do. We're making a 90% nine iron swing, trying to cut it 2 yards or draw it 2 yards, whatever the kind of the comfortable shot shape is. And then we want to be on time. There's no future, no past. We're not worried about anything in the past, and we're definitely not protecting against anything in the future. And then can we get over it and stay locked into what that intention is? If there's any distraction, a gust of wind, a shadow that kind of grabs your attention too much, I'm backing off, I'm going through it again. And then getting over the shot, letting go, swinging freely, being as free as we can be. I can't reiterate that enough, because the minute we protect, we're typically protecting against something happening in the future that we're worried about. And it's really hard for our brain to just let go and swing freely. The only time I will allow my players to grab something in the past is if it's a good experience with that club or that type of shot during that day or another time on that hole. But I'm also very careful about that, because again, all situations are a little bit different. And so trying to not grab onto anything in the past, trying to not worry about anything in the future, be as precise as we can be, let go and swing freely.
Yeah. So if I'm pulling together a little bit, the first is there just seems to be a stage of just information gathering where you are essentially trying to get what the shot demands or what it requires, right? Like, what are the parameters that the shot is being and the context with the shot is being played, just in terms of what the golf course and the conditions are offering for it, right? So that includes, if we're just getting down the basics, it is a yardage to the flag, perhaps. It's also understanding where the front and the back of the green are, understanding where the wind might be and what directions and how strong, what the temperature might be. A variety of different things that are contributing to the decision you would make about what shot to hit, what club it might be, what shape, et cetera. So just information gathering. And it's not a surprise why you see players on the top tours and even just any level of competitive golf, they tend to take more time before a shot than most amateurs do. You could argue that that is a good thing or a bad thing, depending on whether you are the spectator or not. But the bottom line is that there is a certain amount of time that players take to gather enough information to figure out what the shot requires. Sometimes that's relatively straightforward, and other times it's definitely not.
Yep.
So we might just say stage one is just information gathering. And what I liked about what you talked about there, Chase, was that it's a pretty neutral information gathering. So it's not, oh, this is a good wind or this is a bad wind, this is a good lie or a bad lie, although there might be lies that we prefer more than others or winds we prefer. It's not, oh, there's no places on this hole that we wouldn't want to hit the golf ball. It's like, yes, there's a bunker here, there's water here. So you are acknowledging what it is that the shot demands as part of your information gathering process.
Yeah. 100%. And the one thing I keep coming back to is strategy. Whether, like, I like to use, you know, military ideas, like if the military is going in and doing an operation, how much information are they going to gather? And then what does the mission call for? Like, what is their game plan? And now, you know, I'll have players say all the time, like, I read a putt and I knew it wasn't going to, I knew I misread it. And I'm like, then what are we doing? Right. We're just basically setting ourselves up for failure. Even if we're not sure, we still got to be locked in and committed to something, right? Like, a military general is going to go in and come up with the best game plan and see if they can execute it, right? Like, I go back to like math-based strategies. Like, what's the blackjack strategy? If you've got a six and the dealer's showing a 10, you've got to hit on that six. You're supposed to hit on that six no matter what, no matter how it feels, you know? And that's, to me, that's kind of the goal. We're trying to take feelings away. We're trying to just be as precise as we can. Now, there are sometimes feelings like if you felt better throughout the day swinging a hard club versus a soft club, then that's fine. Whatever you can commit to and believe in, I'm completely fine with. But again, it needs to be a pretty short-term memory feel or short-term feel. It can't be something that you're grabbing on from a year ago, at least in my opinion. I think that makes it really, well, I felt like I did this a year ago and I needed to know, like, that, that doesn't work. Like, again, whatever we can do to be as precise as possible, I think gives us the best. Aim small, miss small is the old cliche, and I think it gives us the best chance to succeed.
Yeah, and we probably wouldn't say we don't want to include feelings, but if you, your feelings would be one of the factors that contributes to the decision you're going to make,
not the,
rather than the decision. Like, well, again, and here's the downside with us feeling anxiety is that when we feel it, oftentimes we make that feeling the priority. Like, well, if I'm feeling it, there must be a reason that I need to try to hit a series swing and not screw up, or I must be in trouble, or what it might be, where that's a feeling that may or may not be true. And then therefore I'm going past a bunch of objective information that actually gives me much clearer and more valuable information about how to play a shot rather than just based on how I feel. Similarly, if you feel a shot, like I just feel that this is, I just feel this shot, although that might be helpful at times, it could also, again, you not take into account wind, so on and so forth. It's not uncommon for tour players to tell me, I felt great over this shot, hit it exactly how I wanted to. And afterward, I didn't realize that because I hadn't paid attention to where the wind was. And then that ball ended up in a place that I didn't want to, even though I hit a really good shot.
Yeah, for sure.
So again, we're not asking people to overthink a golf shot. What we're asking them to do is like, hey, let's gather some information about what this shot requires in a neutral way that may include what you feel about it in terms of what you decision you might ultimately make.
For sure. And, right. and the better you are, the more the gut feeling does play a role. And again, like you said, Doc, it comes back to if you're in between clubs and your gut feeling, you just feel better with this one, or the gut feeling says it's the nine, then hit the nine. As long as you're clear and committed to it, we always have to accept if something bad happens. But to me, it's easier to accept if we let go and hit it versus if we were second guessing it the whole time and didn't commit to anything.
Yeah. And we might also add that it's easier to second guess when you haven't gathered enough information to be able to be clear on what, instead of guessing, right? So you have a more clear idea of what you're trying to do. We might also say that overthinking something and overanalyzing it also tends to lead to second guessing, because again, you're going, well, where's the option that is ensuring that I won't hit a shot into a place that I don't want to? That also tends to lead to second guessing because there's no future that includes that possibility. So there is a point of diminishing returns where, yes, I'm gathering information and then it becomes too much because I'm trying to find out too much, right?
For sure. So
I might start, step one is information gathering. I might say the next step. So here's just a framework from three or four different players I've talked to in the last week about kind of along the lines of this question. And it won't be a surprise that most of them, the general framework, although there's some personal differences in between, general framework is the same. It starts with information gathering. What is this shot requiring? There's also a level of acknowledgement about what the shot demands. So if we're translating this into terms that Raymond would use, that's, I'm accepting of the fact that there's water right, there's water deep, there's a bunker here. This is what the shot requires. And whether I want it to or not, that's what it is. So I'm dealing with it on its own terms, which again, offers me the opportunity to choose, well, then how do I want to play this shot? Which the next step would be clarifying what is the shot that you want to pursue. So if we're going 1, 2, 3 to start with, it's information gathering, acknowledging that there is some demand and risk involved with this, then clarifying what is the shot that I am trying to pursue right now. Then as you step into a ball or you're getting ready to, there is perhaps a swing thought involved with that, which might be a do this, to do this. But again, it's a do this or a this in pursuit of the shot I want, rather than a, well, don't do this and don't do this because we don't want it to go there. So again, if you're talking very strict psychological terms, everything is in the affirmative. Do this in pursuit of this, right? And what I might add to the deeper layer of that, that it, before a shot you step in, they're also identifying, well, what are the reasons? So you might say the, what is the because behind it? So what that might look like is I'm going to, at this target, I'm going to feel this motion and swing freely toward that target because, and then fill in the blank. That gives me the best shot of playing successfully. That gives me the best chance of hitting a really good shot and the miss being minimal. That gives me the best chance to pursue what I'm really after, which is playing this hole as well as I can, shooting the lowest score I can. So again, I'm almost leveraging reasons for me to do and pursue freely, rather than leveraging the reasons for me not to, right? So if we're talking about what that looks like for humans, this is a state of ambivalence. Ambivalence is I can make a case either way, to play this shot scared or to play this shot freely. And the because, you're leveraging, well, what are the reasons to do this in the way that I really want to do this? So you're kind of overemphasizing, perhaps you might feel like, or really clarifying, well, I'm going to play this shot freely because, and then fill in the blanks, rather than often what we do with anxiety, which is, ooh, I'm going to steer this thing to the right because that'll save me from left, right? So I've made a case for my brain for avoidance rather than making a case for pursuit.
Okay, so let's dive into that a little bit. So go back to 17 at Sawgrass, a high stressful type shot.
It's a very demanding shot.
Yeah, raises the stress levels. It's a tough shot, right? If I can swing freely, if I can accept all outcomes, that is going to maximize my chance of success.
Stacks the deck in your favor really, really high. Yeah. Particularly if you're playing in the players, you're probably a skilled enough player that if you execute freely, the likelihood of you hitting in the water is very, very low. Yep. And the likelihood of you hitting a functional golf shot is very, very high.
The problem with avoidance, the problem with protection is now we're protecting against an outcome that we don't want, even though that from a that sounds like that should work, right? It sounds like the more we protect, we can make safer swings and we can keep ourselves from getting into trouble. And so that can trick our brain into thinking that's the best way to go again, because the brain's trying to keep us alive. It's trying to help us survive, and it views water as certain death. But it doesn't work because it doesn't allow us to access our skills, to control our speeds, to control the physical tools that we need to control to hit good golf shots.
Right. So if you make a case for your brain that it should do something out of avoidance, it is likely to move in that direction. And again, the reason it's not that it's quote unquote bad, but if we are trying to thrive, which hitting a shot into the 17th at Sawgrass requires a thriving based golf shot for giving yourself the best chance to be successful. So again, when I am resisting, please don't hit it in the water, don't hit it long, do whatever, from a psychological standpoint, not necessarily strategic, then what I'm doing is giving my brain good reason to try to avoid the water rather than hit it where I want to. Now I'm multitasking with avoidance in a way that, again, the whole reason for that is because it disrupts our physical skills. Now my sequencing, my application of force, and my ability to focus on the target that I've really chosen becomes disrupted. And if I told you, you've got a 135-yard wedge shot for most tour players, and center of the green would be a really nice outcome. If they play those shots freely, the likelihood of that ending up in the water is very, very small. Sorry. But if I then said, you played that shot doing everything you could not to hit it into the water, now your sequence, which it's usually a partial shot for them, depending on how much spin they're trying to put on that shot, your sequence is now messed up. You're probably going to apply either too much or too little force because your sequencing is screwed up and you're not actually focused on your target. You're really focused on where do I not want this thing to hit. Now, what does that percentage look like? It's much more likely that that's going to be a less functional golf shot and or flirting with water, right? So again, what we're doing is we're not saying we don't care about the outcome. We're saying I care very much about the outcome. And because I care very much about the outcome, that's the reason why I want to play this thing in a way that gives me the best chance to be successful. And by the way, also would feel great if I did it that way.
It's so funny because it's such a vicious circle. We don't want to hit it in the water. We've got to accept that we need to hit it in the water. But yet even there's times where we're going to go full acceptance and we still may hit it in the water. And that's the hard part, right? Because the nine times that we go full acceptance and it feels great and we don't hit it in the water, we're like, yeah, we got it. And then one time that we go full acceptance and we do hit it in the water, it's like, oh, well, this doesn't work anymore. And now the brain's like, we got to go full right back into protection.
That's right. And that is our brain's default setting to overestimate the likelihood of negative outcomes and overestimate the how consequential they would be in a way where if you took 10 shots and 9 out of 10 of them were really functional and the one that wasn't, our brain is designed to try to gravitate toward that one. Again, go back many thousands of years ago. If you ventured out of the cave into the dangerous world, 9 times out of 10, you were okay. And the one time you got attacked by a saber-toothed tiger, which one do you think your brain is going to remember?
That's good.
So that comes now back to our level of awareness of going, okay, that is the risk involved. And am I willing to take that risk that, yes, I'm going to stand up here and hit 10 free really good golf shots. And again, depending on your current skill level, there's always a chance it ends up in a place that I don't want. Right. And if you watched the players this last year, you saw that on 17, where there were some dudes who made really, really free golf swings, but the ball landed on a downslope and skid somewhere and left them a really difficult putt, or perhaps end up in the water, or they played a shot super, super freely, but probably picked a shot that was too much spin and it came off and rolled into the water, right? So again, there is always the possibility you could execute a really free golf shot and it end up in a place that you don't want, even for the most skilled players in the world. Yep. What makes playing shots freely and with acceptance of all possible outcomes there really, really valuable is because it's so hard to do, right? And it's hard to do because our brain is designed to focus on, dear God, I got to save you from even a low possibility thing. And then we typically throw on a bunch of fixed mindset type narratives on it that make it very much worth it to do that, right? Man. So if we're just talking about shot DNA, we're going information gathering, clarity of pursuit, an action plan for that pursuit, which might include a swing thought. And then there's, can I have some reason, or I'm acknowledging the risk involved with a shot, which is, may perhaps I play this really freely and it doesn't go where I want. And it's the low percent thing, but it does happen sometimes. And then the last part of that is having reasons to do that when I could very easily argue the other way.
So a couple of big ideas here. The last 20 minutes, guys, has been some fantastic information that I know, Doc, you talk to your players about all the time. I talk to my players about all the time. Go back and listen to it again, because there are so many good nuggets as far as just from even just the last little 5 minute run on acceptance. But a couple of things that I would say, you mentioned a swing thought or feel. It can be a thought. It can be a swing feel. It can be a swing position, like post-impact, like I'm going to hold my finish. It can be a window in the sky. It can be a grip pressure feel. Anything I would say to keep your attention or to keep your focus. How would you agree with that?
I would say not just focus, but that it is like, what is the action required for me to move toward the shot that I am trying to pursue?
Yeah.
Right. So again, it's not just, okay, focus on this and that will keep me from thinking about something else, although that might be a nice product. It's like, well, how do I want to pursue the shot that I want? And the more clear I am and the more I have swing thoughts, swing feels, whatever, to actually help me move in that direction, now I'm basically, instead of competing tasks, I have like collaborative tasks involved with it. So again, the conversation I had with a tour player the other day is like, I was like, if right now you acknowledged the danger in a shot, quote unquote danger, but then you were really clear on what is the shot that you want to pursue, what would that look like? And he goes, well, I would acknowledge that there's water right. And I would also clarify that I'm aiming here. Then this is the best course of action for me. Then I asked, okay, well, then what would the do this to pursue that look like for you? And he was like, there's a backswing thought and there's a finish thought for him. Okay. And if I do those two things, it is in pursuit of the that I have just clarified.
It's not a guarantee. Right. It's
not a guarantee.
It's set me up for success. Right. It's not a guarantee. I'm not chasing that swing thought for a guarantee that it's going to produce a perfect result.
Right. It is just, that is what helps me pursue that with the most freedom, the most efficiency, and by the way, the highest likelihood of moving an outcome in a direction that I want to. So again, he's not pretending the outcome doesn't matter, or that, you know, that there isn't water to the right. He's acknowledging both of those things. And he's leveraging them as reasons to play this shot really freely and make swing thoughts in a direction that are going to move me in that way. All right. So again, it might feel like he's overthinking, but it's actually the exact opposite. His overthinking comes from, I'm trying to not think about the water, right? Which once you see it, there you go. Which one of the things that he said was, when I look down at the ball and I look over toward my target and I eventually do catch that water out of my eye, now all of a sudden I have like a flood of thoughts, like a cluster of thoughts, because now here's all the, uh-oh, you can't let it this, because I haven't acknowledged that before I stepped into the golf ball. So it's a surprise to your brain, right? Our brain doesn't like surprises as much as we like to think we do, right? No. And then on top of that, now all of a sudden I have a bunch of thinking, because it's all, well, how do I make sure the ball doesn't go over there? And there is no end to that list of swing thoughts. So now I have 10 different things I'm trying to do rather than just one or two. And they, by the way, they are all competing tasks, because one is pursue the target. But all the things that I'm talking about are, don't go here, don't do this, don't over rotate, don't overturn, you know, don't hold the club face too much, et cetera. And all of these things, again, when you start doing that, that's where the overthinking starts to come from and things get more complicated, not less complicated.
The last thing I'll say too is, like, with my younger players that we're working on just being focused and staying locked in for 18 holes and for all the shots and stuff. The two questions I always ask them was, you know, were they on basically on time and accepting of all outcomes after they hit it? And then the other thing I would say, and it's kind of really the one question I would say, is were there any distractions from the time they took it back to the finish? Were there any distractions? Yeah, I was worried about this. Okay, so then that goes back to an acceptance issue. Yeah, I heard that car drive by and it caught my attention, right? Because there's so many noises and so many things moving on the ground and so many variables on the golf course. And so I would also challenge you guys to like see how many times you made a distracted golf swing. Our intention was a nice little draw. We were going to feel like we got a little deeper in the backswing and held the finish, right? Whatever you needed to do to hit that draw. And then how many times did your brain go somewhere else during that 1 second of movement that could have caused you to change your speeds, change your tension, flinch a little bit, you know? And it's amazing how many times players will say, yeah, I was completely distracted. I saw your foot move and that's where my brain went to.
Yeah. I mean, if we're really thinking about, distractions, they come in two different general forms. The first is an external thing, which is the environment. That's I heard something, saw something, like my sensory external sensory experience shifted my focus, right? Then there's the internal ones. And if we're really talking about what a low level of acceptance does for us, is it gives us very good reason to distract ourselves. Yeah. Like if I'm trying to pursue a certain golf shot, but in the back of my mind, I'm really trying to avoid a bunch of other ones. I have distracted myself. Like I've given myself multiple tasks. So think of distraction as just multitasking. Being focused means I'm focused on one thing, when it's happening, and how I want to do it. Being distracted is I am focused on a bunch of other things that are either not related and not relevant or opposing. Right. So that low level of acceptance will invite both of the latter. Well, you start focusing on things that are not relevant yet, which is the future or the past, and opposing, meaning avoidance based. Right. And if you took any golfer in the world of any skill level and you have them distracted by irrelevant and oppositional tasks, their skill set and their ability to play freely and play well is going to be disrupted. Right. Now, the challenge that you're really getting to with this, Chase, is kind of part of our larger conversation today is that's really difficult to do when it's really difficult to do.
Yeah, right.
Right. Because again, our brain is designed to go, you don't want that to happen. You should resist it rather than perhaps allow for the possibility of it. Right. But in the larger picture here, too, and, you know, without going too far on a tangent, if you think about all the things in our lives that we really pursued that are most meaningful to us, whether that's relationships, jobs, whatever, we were willing in one degree or another to take a real risk. Like there's a chance, maybe a small chance, but a chance this doesn't go the way that I want to. We're willing to be vulnerable in that risk. And that's what made it powerful enough for us to be able to pursue. The challenge with that is bringing that to golf shots sometimes for us, or rounds of golf, or golf competitive situations, whether my tour card is at stake, where the more I tend to resist these things, the more I'm getting in my own way in the pursuit of them. But what I'm really looking for is, where is the option where failure doesn't happen, or a 0% chance of failure? And there's no strategy in the world that has a 0% chance of failure.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And I think back to some of the best shots I've ever hit. There was a sense of risk involved. There was a sense of like, I'm going for this. I'm gonna hit this shot. And then some of my biggest, some of the biggest failures I had on the golf course were me trying to protect a lead, or me trying That's to right. hang on and not screw up. And like, it just feels horrible.
You know, and I might share with the audience and with you a similar experience. Again, all humans, our brains are designed in a similar way, and we learn that avoidance. Like when I was younger, I was a pretty elite level soccer player. But my junior and senior year of high school, like I was just an ordinary player, not because my skill level was that, but because I played a lot just trying to not screw up. Like don't let a ball run under your foot. Don't let a pass go out of bounds. Like all of these things. And it was a whole lot less fun, and I didn't play very well versus the times in my career where I was like, look, mistakes happen. If I'm going to play this position, I'm going to at times make bad touches. I'm going to pass to the wrong team sometimes. I'm going to go for goal sometimes, and I'm just going to miss. And those were the times where I by far played the best and enjoyed it the most. And by the way, you're able to get better faster because you know what works and what doesn't.
Yeah.
Right. And the challenge with that is our default response is resist what you don't want to happen, even though the best course of action is go for what you want, see how it shakes out.
That's exactly right.
So, okay. So somewhat related to that, we'll get to question two here. We had someone asking about, well, what are some, and we might say practical strategies for starting to separate your identity from your craft, right? So we did have a couple, we've mentioned this a couple of times in podcasts, where we're talking about like, well, essentially a coupling of self and craft is I have taken my identity or my value as a human, and I have put it in the hands of what are the results that I'm producing. You know, you might hear this also known as like athletic identity or performance identity, where really what the issue is not that we identify as good golfer or whatever it might be, it's how much, right? So we have what's called identity foreclosure, which is I put all my identity eggs in this basket, which means when I'm playing and competing, I'm usually bringing a lot of anxiety and avoidance. So if I told you the thing that you as a human being in your psychological framework hold most dear, which is who am I and how important am I and valuable am I in the world, is now at stake when you go compete, because that is the only way or the primary way with which you figure that out, you're going to be protective. So when stakes matter most to you, you're going to play safe, not because you want to, but because your brain is going, the thing that is really, really important to you, which is your identity, is at stake. And research around identity is super clear that when we as humans feel that our identity is being threatened or marginalized, we get defensive. So again, think about the things we identify as Democrat or Republican, male or female, all of these kind of, you know, big picture things where when someone starts saying something like, no, I don't think that's right, or you're incorrect, which is just another way of saying you're not correct, or you are, you know, you don't think you are what you think you are, we start to get really defensive about that. And oftentimes how that plays out in our performance is now we're bringing anxiety to it, which is just another way. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt you, but even if like somebody said you're not good enough.
You're not good enough. That's right. Right. So it's not. So if I identify as I am good golfer, now the question becomes, well, what if I don't think I'm good enough? What if other people don't think I'm good enough? And what if the way I'm playing golf and the results I'm getting are telling me I'm not what I think I am? There's your identity foreclosure or identity crisis, which is if I don't think I know who I think I am, I need to figure it out. But the means by which I'm figuring it out is what's creating the crisis in the first place. Right. So there's a huge difference, subtle, but huge difference between I identify as someone who plays golf and is skilled at golf versus I am good golfer, period, end of sentence. Really dangerous identity. And we might put this into the category of fixed mindset if we're going back to our conversations about fixed and growth. And the danger with a fixed mindset is my identity becomes paired to these noun-based identifiers, smart, good, talented, special, whatever that might be, and the outcomes associated that would tell you you are or aren't. And then the problem becomes is when those outcomes are not even just not available, but might be unavailable, now my identity is threatened. And then, of course, that's going to lead to all issues with confidence being super unstable. And it becomes this cycle where I put a ton of pressure on myself to just produce outcomes. And when that doesn't work, I put a ton of pressure on myself to not produce poor outcomes.
Sure.
And now I'm playing out of avoidance, and now I'm bringing anxiety. Then I get frustrated, and this cycle goes around and around. And anybody who's been in this cycle, I know I was during those years that I just mentioned for soccer wise, it's not an enjoy. You love the thing, but you don't love engaging with it because again, it becomes a super threat to identity. Okay.
And how do you slowly break it?
Yeah. One of the primary ways that we can start to break this is by really like coming back and kind of going through your history and going, well, where did it pair in the first place? And what usually happens is we did something that was successful and people gave us those labels. You're really good, or you're a special player, or you have a lot of potential, which is like a really dangerous phrase to just start throwing out flippantly. Right. And what we did is we go, oh, that feels good. And then again, our brain learns, well, play well, get feedback that feels good. Well, then what I got to do is play well to feel good, right? So it creates this association. Well, what's going to make me feel good? Well, producing good results. Downside is when we don't get that type of feedback, or the opposite of it, which is, oh, maybe you're not a good player, or, oh, I thought you were a better player than that. And that type of feedback, again, now that's the other side of the coin where, again, it's further stitching my identity to my performance. But in a way where I'm going, now I have to protect my identity, protect my identity, protect my identity. And if we're just talking about being distracted, whatever your skill level is, whatever your performance realm is, priority on the surface is go pursue playing well. But underneath the surface, it's protect your identity. You are distracted the entire time.
Yeah.
Right. So go back through your history. Go, well, where did this come together? And you almost ask yourself, if no one had said anything after this tournament or this shot, what conclusions would I have made from it? Right. Similar to, well, if nobody told me Santa Claus existed and I didn't watch it on TV, would I have believed it in the first place? So you're almost challenging retroactively the means by which this pairing came together in the first place. And you're not trying to pull it apart. You're just trying to see like, oh, of course, this is what happened, but that doesn't make it true. So you're almost challenging the narratives and the experiences behind it. Not that you didn't win a tournament and people told you how great you were, but how valuable that feedback really is and what form it comes in, which is just this fixed mindset type of stuff. And again, you might also acknowledge very well-intentioned. People were trying to boost my confidence, encourage me, et cetera, but the means by which they did it started to pair my identity. So it's really, that's kind of the process for how it happened. There'll be a good place to start. Another thing that you can do is start to challenge it with some current evidence, meaning, for example, well, when I pair my identity to my performance, what do I actually get from it? Like, what are the natural consequences right now? And if those aren't things that are in line with what you want to experience, how it's impacting your performance, the life it's creating for you, again, you can leverage them as means to do something different. So for example, if I go, well, my identity is currently paired via this history, what impact is it having on my life right now? Nothing good in relation to what I want, or it's creating a ton of anxiety. I don't enjoy the thing that I want more. That, again, helps disenchant you with the idea that you have to pair your identity to your performance. Okay. So again, what we're really asking is like, if you challenge the idea that Santa Claus exists and then ask, well, believing fully that Santa Claus exists as an adult, what impact is that having on my life? I don't really love what that is. You know, a question that I ask a lot of clients with this is like, is there anything you really don't like about having your identity paired to your performance right now? And they'll go, this. That matters. It's a process that, again, we call disenchantment, which is we have to pay attention to like, this is not working anymore, even though it might have worked in the past.
And so if we were going to, you've used the word pair a bunch, if we were going to repair with something else, it would be, you know, working hard. It would be the love of the game. It would be trying just, you know, the pursuit of getting better, the pursuit of, you know, improvement or of, you know, what, you know, whatever the case may be. It's more of the process rather than, you know, an adjective. It's rather
right. Less of an adjective and more a verb. Something. Yeah. So again, what would fall under the category of our effort and action, choices, and what you focus on, right? And you might even put in that category what you value,
yeah,
right? So what we value most when our identity is paired to our performance is safety in the form of identity. What we value most when we're playing freely is often things like pursuit, the present, being competitive, like all these things that we can choose to engage with directly rather than hold dear in a way that comes at a cost to us. And if you're getting really, really philosophical on this one, Chase, you might even bring up the idea, why do I need to pair my identity to anything? Right. And that's, you know, a bit of a metaphysical approach to it, but it's also, it can be quite powerful to people. Like, what would it look like if I didn't pair my identity to things in such a strong way in my life? And there's no rule that says that I have to. Then you're getting to the next thing, Chase, which is almost starting to create, well, what would it look like? How might my experiences and my performance change if I were to loosen this grip to my identity?
Yeah.
And what that usually looks like is, well, I would probably have less anxiety. I would be able to be present more often. I'd have more access to my skills. I might enjoy the thing that I'm doing much more. Yeah. I wouldn't be living and dying by any one outcome at a time, which is like walking on eggshells while you're doing something that eggshells walking on is not super helpful for. And you're almost starting to go, okay, so I can see making a case for this is not a good idea for me. And then making a case for things that are credible and important to you for a reason to change. So one of the things we know about research in my field, especially if you looked at a session that I was working with somebody, you would see on an underlying level that part of the way I listen to people is trying to help them talk themselves into doing something different. that is more in line. So we call this change talk. The more we talk about making a move in another direction and changing the way we think about something, engage with it, show up to it, the more likely we are to be able to do that. So what you're doing is you're essentially, again, ambivalence is, I can make a case for this, if I can make a case for this, you're only making a case for the direction that you want to move, which is this sucks, this sucks, this sucks, this would be better, this would be better, this would be better. And doing so in a way that, again, is credible for, like, these are the things I really do want to experience, and these are the things I don't really want to experience anymore, or at least not to the same degree or same frequency.
Right.
And then the last part, so again, we have this kind of conceptual understanding of what it means to separate yourself and craft, because we understand why, we understand what it's currently doing, we understand conceptually what it might do for me. What pairs conceptual understanding in our direct experience is action. And what that means is I've got to do things differently. So here's an example, again, from several clients, where when I've paired myself to my identity and I don't play well, I typically brood all day. I'm in a crappy mood. I don't talk to people. And like, here's the list of behaviors that they engage with afterward. That, again, just keeps the cycle going. Okay, so the conceptual understanding is, I know this is not good for me. Something else would be better. Now it goes, well, what is the actual action that takes that conceptual understanding and puts it into play so that you could actually experience what it feels like to not have your identity paired? And that's a before, during, and after. So before is, I'm going to play freely, right? And again, there's a level of acceptance there that has to come with it, because then that allows me the opportunity to feel what it feels like to actually play freely and see the likelihood of better results. During, it's, well, when I make a mistake, usually I get even tighter and I play even safer and whatever. No, I'm going to do the opposite. And again, it's not forced, it's allowed. And then afterward, if I don't play well, instead of brooding and whatever, you know, the question that I often ask players is, what would you do today if you shot a 65? Well, I'd probably go talk with friends. I would hang out. I'd do my recovery. I'd probably hit a few balls just to kind of key in on what I was doing. And then I'd probably enjoy myself the rest of the night doing blank. Let's do that when you shoot a 75. Right? Because, and again, the reason isn't, hey, pretend you feel great about a 75. It's, no, I don't have to do that. I know it's not helpful, and I know this other option would be more helpful. So can I choose to do something that is more in line with what I want to bring to my golf experience rather than waiting to feel like it?
Versus running back to the hotel room and pouting.
And just pouting and doing whatever and just being in a bad mood. It's a cool thing, because it doesn't take a ton. It only takes a couple of times for us to go, oh, clearly this is better. That I can play a poor round of golf and not decide I'm going to have a terrible day.
Yeah,
but to do that, you have to actually try it in a way that allows you to experience this is clearly the better option. In the same way that if you come to a round of golf going, I'm not going to pair my identity to it, I'm just going to play and see what it's like to not have to give my ego a feed the whole time, you go, oh, this is way better, right? So what that might look like before is, there's an exercise I do with, usually, by the way, it's middle-aged and older men with golf. But the rule is, you're going to play a round of golf and you don't get to shot or round-splain anything. Meaning, if I hit a poor shot, it's not, oh, my shoes and the club. And it was just a poor shot. Period, end of sentence. No qualifiers that allow me to protect my identity and my ego. After the round of golf, what did you shoot? This is the number. Period, end of sentence. No explaining this shot, this whatever. So again, what you're doing is you're making a rule to act in a way that is consistent with the belief and the unpairing of the identity that you're trying to create for yourself, right? So again, there's one thing, there's a conceptual understanding. The other is, what does the action actually look like to do that? And then can I choose to allow myself to do that even though I feel like doing something different? Then you have the opportunity to have a different direct experience, and then you will feel like doing that more in the future. Right.
I want to preach this to my parents, because I wasn't very good at this. If I shot 80 in an AJGA, I went straight home and pouted. If I shot 70 or under, I was hanging out and talking and eating and practicing and acting completely different.
Right. So there, what you're basically doing for your brain is reinforcing this transactional and conditional relationship that I have to play good to feel good, which is just another level of, if you play good, you're a good golfer. If you don't, you're not.
And another thing I keep thinking about, I had a player a few years ago that was 11, 12-year-old, was a little smaller than everybody else and just had a chip on their shoulder and loved to compete and got really good, turned 13 and got all the staff deals from all the companies. And then quit growing for a little bit. Everyone else kind of took off and got faster and longer and bigger and everything. And then he was almost like worried about losing his staff deals. And like, he'd been fighting his whole life to be really good. He got to that point and then it was like, oh, I've got to maintain it. And his mindset completely changed. And when you were explaining all that, I just kept going back to all these kids that at an early age have some success. And then now that's all they care about. Their good golf pairs with stuff and pairs with rankings and pairs with all this.
Well, those deals is just another form of fixed mindset feedback. That's You're right. good. Here's a thing. So it's just again, a transaction. Play good, get stuff. Again, I don't want to pretend the world isn't transactional in some places.
Right.
But just because the external world is transactional or other people bring a transactional relationship to us and our performance does not mean that we have to. You can, of course, accept gear. I wouldn't tell anybody not, or money. Yep. And anybody who's trying to perform well is going to be exposed to both criticism and praise. It is our responsibility to pay attention to what is the relationship that we are bringing to all of that, right? And where does my identity play into it? Yep. To your point, though, parents, you are the primary architect of that when kids are young, because if you tell a kid you're good at golf and they get a bunch of stuff for it, no kidding, their identity is going to pair to that.
100%. Right?
So this is also, again, not to go off a tangent, but like the danger of giving kids trophies for everything is that like you're almost more likely to pair their identity to something, even if their performance is not commensurate with that pairing, in a way that now they are paired to their identity and their skill level is in no way ready to protect that identity. So that's another layer to that. But the bottom line is that we as adults, the feedback that we give young people through their failures and successes is pairing their identity either to the things they do and how they show up and engage with it, choices, actions, focus, or the outcomes, those adjective identity identifiers, which are certainly two different trajectories in terms of what type of anxiety we start to learn, the types of habits we try to learn, because again, the priority becomes ego protection and identity protection, not performance when we're doing that.
So perfect segue. You brought up trophies. So we had a question about dopamine and its effects on us when we are actually in pursuit mode. So when we're pursuing what we want, we hit a bad shot. How does that affect us? How does that affect our dopaminergic state?
Yeah. Think about the dopaminergic play out in that way, like a cake. There's layers to it. There's the ingredients and then there's the frosting. Okay. So if I'm playing really freely, my brain is, and I'm again, part of the reason that playing freely helps is a high dopaminergic experience is not just because I'm playing freely for the reasons that are free, like that all matters, but also part of it is it's a lot easier to be present. And when I'm pursuing what I want in the future by being present in it as it's playing out, that's a high dopaminergic experience. So you can, if you're using the cake analogy, you're getting dopamine from the ingredients, which are far more stable and reliable because they're always available. The present moment and pursuing a shot in front of us, even if it's not one we like, is always available to us. And when we do that on our terms for the reasons that are important to us rather than just what I'm afraid of, that feels really good for us. It makes effort enjoyable. You can think about the outcomes we get at the end of it. So let's say I play a really free round of golf and I shoot a really low score and I win a golf tournament. That's the icing on the cake. And yes, that does include certain spikes in dopamine, but they're very short-lived. And they're like, our brain does see them as icing on the cake. It goes, yes, that's what I was after. Love that. It also comes with these such opportunities. That's great. But that's not really why I was here, right? That is what I was after. And I'm glad it happened. And I'm going to try to do it again. But that's not the source that I'm after, right? So dopamine from the ingredients of the cake, the way we show up and engage with our performance and over time and under pressure is what makes that pressure feel good, even though it can be uncomfortable. Okay. It makes effort enjoyable for us. And it also helps us remember what we did in a way that we can replicate in the future, which is why it feels more sustainable. So if you played that way and you got poor results, it's just cake without icing, which again, it's not that you would want that. You would prefer your cake with icing. But if you didn't get it, it's just kind of, it's a bit of a short-term dip. But the thing is, because I'm not building my dopaminergic stores on outcomes, when they're not available to me, I still have the ingredients of the cake to go to, which gives me the foundation to go pursue the next layer of frosting, you might say.
Right? So, would you say that the bad outcomes don't have as much of an effect on you, whether short-term or long-term?
They tend to be seen more. Yeah, the poor outcomes tend to be seen more as learning experiences, meaning I go, okay, well, I did that the way I wanted to, and it didn't end up the way I wanted it to. So I meet it more with a sense of curiosity. That's our cognitive processing of error feedback that comes with when we are more of a growth mindset, and the way we're engaging with something is the primary means by which we are getting our dopamine, we might say. And so it doesn't stick with us as long, and it's not felt as emotionally. Remember, in a fixed mindset, error feedback is processed emotionally, which means we tend to take it personally, which is just another way of saying I needed that outcome to feel okay or to make this worth it. And when that is the case, again, you need frosting on your cake. And if you need frosting on your cake, the question becomes, well, what happens if the frosting's not available to you? Hence why if your identity is paired to outcomes, the work itself feels worse because you're taking error feedback emotionally, yep. Meaning personally. And remember, dopamine also plays a significant role in how we experience the passage of time, which means not only does it feel worse, it feels longer. Therefore, it's less likely that I'm going to be resilient through it. So really paired to the thing itself, and the outcomes are the frosting on the cake that, yes, indeed, I am pursuing and motivated by, but not required for me to enjoy the experience, be engaged with it, be present, and not required for me to decide how I'm going to engage with it, then they become things that can come and go. You can get new layers of frosting, but the stuff in between is what really is the mainstay.
And the only thing I was going to say, Doc, is that's why when we're on time, it feels like it goes by fast.
It does. It's an interesting interplay with time. So if you think about flow state is a high dopaminergic experience for us, where when we're in it, it feels like things are really just moving at the exact speed that we need to. That's us being synced with the actual passage of time. But afterward, it feels like went by in an instant, right? That's dopamine. The opposite, when we pair our identity or we're bringing a bunch of resistance and low acceptance to what we're doing and trying to force things to happen in a way that is just really multitasking with avoidance, is again, the thing itself becomes less enjoyable and feels like it lasts longer. And by the time, like, you're basically, it's the old, if you watch the kettle, it takes forever to boil. Like, it's the same amount of time, but it sure feels a whole lot different, yeah. Right? Hence why the things that we do that make it harder for us to be present are also the things that tend to diminish the amount of enjoyability we have within what we're doing.
Man, good stuff. Well, speaking of time flying by, this, we've gotten this thing going fast. Any thoughts, Doc, on closing us out? Again, this acceptance stuff is really difficult, and we touched on how difficult it is at a higher level too. Like the higher the levels, the better we get, the harder it is to accept us not being good enough, or to accept if our good is not good enough. Thoughts?
Yeah. So if we're kind of finishing up here, what you're really referencing is, what do I do when I get to the point in the learning curve or level of performance where I might find out that my best efforts aren't enough to be successful, or at least not successful in the way that I want? Like, there's a risk that if I try my best and do things exactly the way that I want to, for the reasons that I want to, that it doesn't work out. Right. So it's not that, it's basically a microcosm of what you talked about with the tee shot at 17. And to be very clear, this is the existential question for us as human beings that we do not get an opportunity to avoid. We have to address it, and it will come out either us dealing with it on our own terms, or it's going to come out at the times when that risk is direct, which could be, well, I'm going to play a round of golf where my tour card is at stake, or I'm in my club championship and people are going to make judgments about me, could be at the top of your backswing when your identity goes, if you hit this left, we are in trouble, right? So what you're really getting to is what happens when I'm in the situations where me resisting the things that I don't want to happen 100% doesn't work anymore, because just being good at something is not enough to get me through. And there is a possibility I might find out I'm not as good as I blank think I am, feel I am, have identified as, etc. Okay. So this is a really powerful inflection point for a couple of reasons. But one is it shows you you're probably in a place that you want to be. We as humans do not feel vulnerable. We don't feel out of place. We don't feel at risk, and we don't feel uncomfortable when we're not leveling up. So usually what it means is you are in a position where you are doing something that is going to test your current skill levels in a way that less competitive or safer environments do not. It could be a romantic relationship, playing golf, a job interview, moving to a new place that is unfamiliar, unpredictable, taking a risk to go play pro golf or go play at this program, whatever that might be. When we level up, our brain is designed to look before it leaps. And we tend to feel uncomfortable about that. And it can come in a variety of different shades because it's presenting, I don't know if we're going to be good enough here. And that is actually a good place to be in, because it means you're stretching your capacities and you're actually trying to find out where the limits of your potential might be. The other layer that makes it hard for us is it's going to expose your psychology. Just like it's going to expose your strategies, your physical skills, the way you manage your body, all of these things, when we level up, what got us there might not be what gets us through there, which means change is probably required. And if you look at really high performers, one of the common threads is they are very adaptable. They are not afraid to let go of something that does not work for them, even though it used to in the past. So for example, when we get to those places where just being here isn't enough to get me through here, and I feel a little bit out of place, or that I might fail, and there's a possibility of that, oftentimes the anxiety we used to bring to our performance that motivated us to just not screw up ain't going to cut it anymore, because that's not going to allow you to perform well enough. Or one of the NFL teams, the phrase they use is mama's food doesn't cut it anymore, which is the stuff your mom was feeding you in high school that you could get away with, not going to cut it at the NFL level. Because that's not going to give you the type of fuel that your body needs to be able to deal with the day in and day out of this being a job, right? Or if you're going to move to a new place, take on a new job, the things that you did in your old job might not make it through. Some of the things might, but right, all of them will not. And the challenge there is we typically meet that feeling, that leveling up, that increased level of risk, and that increased level of stress, intensity and duration of demand, with resistance. What do I got to do to not screw this up, rather than, okay, that is the risk involved. Can I be willing to find out? And what is it going to require me to let go of, or perhaps grab onto, that will move me through this? And letting go of the things that used to be very predictable, familiar, and perhaps lead to success for us, letting go of those things is hard, because it feels like we are relinquishing ourselves to less, even though that is what opens the door for us to grow more. Then I might add a growth mindset and fixed mindset layer to this, is that when we go, uh-oh, I'm not good enough, and we can acknowledge that, the question becomes, do I go, well, I guess that's it, period, end of sentence, or do I go, I'm not good enough yet? So the underlying question between a growth mindset and a fixed mindset, the main difference is when a fixed mindset finds out they're not good enough, it is a finalized conclusion. In a growth mindset, it's just, yeah, I wasn't good enough yet. And then what do I got to do, or what do I need to let go of to maybe be enough? So there's no end to that. It's just a temporary setback, or a temporary I'm not good enough, not an end all be all. And so when you're leveling up, it's going to expose your mindset, more fixed your growth. It's going to expose your reliance on anxiety, frustration, on these other resistance-based states. It's going to test where your physical skills are, your strategies are, your body, all of these things. And for that, usually that comes with a significant layer of discomfort for us.
That's interesting, because you'll see some players that had a lot of success at the college level, the mini tour level, get to the PGA Tour, and then they play a lot of golf with Rory McIlroy, and then they decide they need to change everything because they can't quite hit it like Rory does, right? So they'll change too much. But then you'll also see the guys that are, that like you said, that are too fixed, that aren't flexible enough, that aren't willing to address some of the things that did work before that aren't going to work at this level. And again, I think it all comes back to like, how does it feel to play in protection mode? Does it feel good? Does it feel like you're giving yourself the best chance to succeed? And every player that I've ever talked to about this says, absolutely not, it doesn't. So then we've got to fully accept and let go and be willing to see what happens. Again, as we've talked about all this in this hour episode, it's much easier said than done, but that's what we've got to try to get to, that mindset, to let go, see what happens, to give ourselves a chance. Like, and I think you and I talked about this a couple of years ago, we would much rather play freely and just be told we weren't good enough than never play freely at all and never find out, even though it kind of sucks and it hurts our heart. Like,
it does. It does hurt. Like, look, finding out that you're just, maybe you did everything you possibly could, played 100% freely, and you found out I'm just not good enough to play pro golf or college golf or win a club championship. That does suck. I want to honor and acknowledge that it does. But the bottom line is it had a chance.
That's right. And it's still
a better experience.
Yeah, correct. And that's what I say. I'm like, look, you'd much rather shoot your shot than never have shot at all and always wonder what if, right? At least you gave it your all and you're like, dude, I wasn't quite as good as I thought I was, but I was, at least we know where you got to.
And I might ask people, is that a risk you're willing to take? And if the answer is yes, then it's like, all right, what level of acceptance is required for you to do that? Again, level of acceptance is not resigning yourself to less, not caring about results, not wanting negative results or negative experience. It means you're open to the possibility of it so that it opens the door for you to actually pursue the things you want with more freedom. The bottom line is that is still not a guarantee of success. And you might find out today, this week, on this shot, or perhaps in the grand arc of things, I wasn't good enough. Now there's risk with that. And if that's a risk you're not willing to take, then it becomes like, okay, maybe this isn't for you. It is not uncommon that when I talk to pro athletes, a lot of them, they go, the risk involved with playing at this level, the financial risk, the social risk, the criticism, the whatever, I don't want to take that risk. I'd rather not do that. And then the question becomes, okay, what would you rather do instead? And that is totally okay. Yep. But if what you really want is to see how good you can be at something, and you are willing to take that risk, then it becomes, all right, well, what do we need to let go of, or what do we need to move toward that actually allow you to possibly find out?
Yep. Right. And I think it all goes back to, if you'll give yourself permission to fail and be okay with failure and learn from the failure, you can be as we'll find out how good you can be. Yeah, and your relationship with failure and your fear of failure is what's going to limit you from reaching your full potential.
Yeah. So to exactly what you said, when we get to the points where the question, what if my best isn't good enough, becomes exposed, our relationships to success and failure also get exposed.
Yeah.
Right. So, and if I have a very avoidant and resistant relationship with failure, meaning I will prioritize avoiding failure over pursuing what I deem success, that's going to get exposed at those points. And again, you might ask, okay, well, why does that become the priority? If I have a fixed mindset, if my identity is paired to my performance and my craft, or I have developed habits that are all avoidance-based, those are certainly contributing factors to that, which is why we have so many people asking about, well, I don't want to do this anymore because what I really want is to be able to do that. The challenge is when you get to certain points in the learning curve where just being good at something isn't enough anymore, all of that's going to start to get exposed, which means it's going to give you where you perhaps need to change. What I would just add before we finish up here is most of the time when players get to the top levels, what they try to change is their technique. And most of the time they're trying to change technique to cover up the insecurities, the identity and all. And if they, again, dealt with that more directly, they would find out what their skills are actually producing, not relative to another player, but relative to the things that they define as successful, rather than I just have to figure out how to hit it farther. Now that might be the case, but you would want to make sure that you're playing freely enough to find out, oh, that's the deficit in my game that I need to be able to. It's the same thing. Putting is by far the most frequent for pro golfers where they go, Raymond, I'm just not putting well enough. My stroke sucks. I'm like, is your stroke suck or are you putting out of anxiety? Because those are two different things.
Well, and I would echo, go back to what I said too, right? Like most players that make, everybody that makes onto the PGA Tour have fairly good mechanics. Like very few people ever get out there that don't hit it really well, putt it really well. They're doing a lot of the physical skills really, really well. Now they can get out there with a mindset that is not conducive to having as much success as they could out there. And then that goes back to your point of being flexible to change and being flexible to let go of some preconceived notions or some stuff that happened to work for you in the past.
Yeah. And to be fair, the demand and the stress and the risk and the vulnerability at playing at the highest levels of golf is real.
Oh yeah.
Which is why pretending you don't care about results or pretending you don't care about people's opinions doesn't work, because you know it's real. And let's also not pretend that physical skill sets are stable all the time. Like they do indeed fluctuate. The issue is that fluctuation, how much of it is self-imposed via my psychology versus just the ups and downs of having to travel with a golf swing all the time.
Yep. That's real good. Well, fantastic episode. And the stuff, the early stuff on the pre-shot routine and then getting into the acceptance and then even the identity stuff was fantastic. You can find Doc asking questions at BTS_mindset on Twitter. You can send us stuff at BTS. Oh, wait a minute. It's been a minute. It's BTS podcast, right? Crud. This has been, we've been so long. I got to look this up. I know I'm Chase Cooper Golf. And we are, it's the Golf Beneath the Surface podcast. I think it's at GBTS. Yep, GBTS podcast. Apologies. It is, you know, it's been a minute when I forget all my Instagram handles. Mm-hmm. But yeah, feel free. Again, we'll do a lot of these kind of more Q&A type episodes just because we get so many questions about some of the topics we've covered. And I think it's good to go in and make sure you guys are kind of following along with us. And honestly, like a lot of the stuff's new for me every episode. The identity stuff was really, really good. I hadn't heard you talk about a lot of this stuff this week. So thanks again, Doc, as always. Take us home.
Well, that'll be it. Again, as Chase said, send us stuff. The next couple episodes, I think we're getting into habits, so we'll try to get those in the next couple weeks here. And in the meantime, thank you very much for listening. Chase, it was good to see you for the first time in a while, my guy.
It's been a minute. Doc, thank you, and thank you guys for listening.
We'll see you.